What's up, Crypt Nation? This is Pizza Mind here with Bryce Paul. And today, our very special guest is Alex Gladstein, the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation. This is not your typical crypto broadcast where we bring in a founder or a CEO to talk about, you know, what kind of emerging tech they're building. Rather, this is someone who's actually using the tech and applying it to make the world a better place. We ran into him at the Bitcoin Is meetup in Los Angeles, and his speech was really, really moving. So I had to have him on the show. Alex, thank you so much for taking your time, and welcome to Crypto 101.
Thanks so much for having me on. Excited to be here, guys.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit, what is the Human Rights Foundation and what is your role there?
Sure. Well, the Human Rights Foundation is a nonprofit charity organization based in New York with a mission of helping promote civil liberties and personal freedoms for people who live under dictatorships and authoritarian regimes around the world. So basically, an organization committed to promoting freedom and liberty and justice under very repressive governments. And that's actually quite a large mission, unfortunately, because today about 4 billion people, billion with a B, live under some sort of authoritarian regime. And we can make jokes about how repressive the United States and Europe are. When we study Bitcoin, we learn more about financial privacy, and there's a lot of things that scare us there. But we're actually talking about actual dictatorships here. So like China, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, Zimbabwe, Eritrea, Iran, Russia, etc. Places where there's no free speech, there's no freedom of assembly, and there's no mechanism for people to hold their government accountable at all. So even when you're just talking about like sort of strict authoritarian regimes, one party states or places where like there's obviously like one dictator, one small group, one oligarchy in charge, that's 4 billion people. So, you know, our mission is to connect with change makers in these societies, give them tools they need, give them a voice, help them tell their story, fund work and research to understand how democracy develops, how individual freedoms and human rights grow. And we have a lot of perspectives when it comes to looking at technology as well. Technology is a driver for change. Generally speaking, you've got two different kinds of technology that we've observed. One is like more pro-individual, we'll say, technology. Things like the open internet, encryption, encrypted messages, Bitcoin. Then there's also technology which is more pro-authoritarian. So that would be like things like big data analysis, artificial intelligence, surveillance, etc.
So I imagine you think that Bitcoin or Ethereum or other public open permissionless blockchains are a net positive for democracy. Is that true?
Yeah, actually, I saw this piece written by a British analyst named Dominic Frisbee about basically, can democracy survive without cash? And I thought it was a really interesting perspective. And, you know, to me, it's more about the monetary aspect of Bitcoin. I'm less interested in the blockchain part of it. I think that Satoshi had to use a blockchain to build Bitcoin, but I'm really not that interested in the non-economic use cases of blockchains. At least I haven't seen their real world impact. I try to be Bayesian about the way I think about these things. So if someone creates some sort of other decentralized application on a blockchain that seems to be changing the world, I will certainly change my mind. But from what I've seen, I like to focus on, you know, what Bitcoin is, how it works, how it's changing the world, how people are adopting it, using it under very difficult political climates, and how it can be sort of like an escape valve. And then just on this thought, like, you know, can democracy survive without cash? I think was really compelling because at the end of the day, financial privacy, as Andreas Antonopoulos says, is and I think I agree with him, is that it's sort of like the human right that undergirds everything else, right? So if you don't have financial privacy, everything else can get taken away from you. And in a society without cash, in a society where all finance has been digitized, and it, you know, assuming we don't have something like Bitcoin, all of your daily activities are being sort of micro-tracked and surveilled. And that's how democracy dies. So actually, I would argue, yes, that Bitcoin is like a really important part of the future of democracy.
Can we talk about how the monetary policy of Bitcoin in and of itself is you know, humanistic, right? So the fact that, so can we talk about like how the current structures of inflation, which is a hidden tax essentially, and, you know, a centralized party being able to control the monetary supply, you know, how is Bitcoin different and powerful in that regard?
So I just wrote a book with a handful of co-authors called The Little Bitcoin Book, which I will shamelessly shill right now.
Sounds awesome.
But we got together this summer in a house with a bunch of other prominent Bitcoiners like Jimmy Song and Elena Vernova, Alejandro Machado, Luis Buenaventura, Lily Liu, and others. And basically, the idea was, let's kind of try to put together a primer on how Bitcoin changes society and politics, things like that. Kind of like a Malcolm Gladwell style kind of fun, curious reader on Bitcoin, which we didn't really feel like existed. They were mainly very like kind of academic or technical, right? But we ended up really focusing the first few chapters on monetary policy and on money and on why money is broken in today's world and how it's broken in today's world. And we ended up looking at like a handful of different reasons for that. And, you know, one is that basically if you don't have access to the dollar or the euro, like, you know, it's not a great situation for you. So several of our co-authors came from countries like Venezuela or the Philippines, former Soviet Union, et cetera, where, you know, they in the last several decades saw their savings, saw their national currency go from, you know, in the case of the Philippines, 1980, it was 7 pesos per a dollar. And today it's like 55 or something like that. And that's like a more gentle rate of inflation. I mean, if you look at like Venezuela, where the inflation rate is 10,000,000%. And I know that's kind of like an outlier, but generally speaking, you know, most governments, most currencies have lost a huge amount of value against the dollar in the last 30 years. most state created currencies only last on average about 27 years. That's the average lifespan of a fiat currency, right?
So, wow, that's quite the statistic.
Yeah, most of them just sort of die or get replaced, right? So in Nigeria, one of the co-authors was teaching us from his experience that, you know, I think in like 92 or 93, the dictator of Nigeria pegged the Naira to 22 per dollar. And what happens when you do an artificial peg like that is like quite obviously the economy does not mirror that peg, right? So what happens is in the black market, there starts to emerge a second price point, which over the next 4, 5, 6 years went up to as high as 88 per dollar, right? 88 Naira per dollar. So what's happening is in this country, you have all these people making public sector wages, right? Like denominated in the official Naira, 22 per dollar. But in reality, the currency was like 4 times weaker. So what that meant is they were getting paid and then they couldn't afford to buy anything. And this is when you get things like shortages and starvation. And you see this all over the world happen many, many times over the past few decades. So when we talk about the monetary policy being, you know, humanistic of Bitcoin, we can dig into that a little bit in terms of like most monetary policies of currencies are prone to abuse and are basically perform really poorly and really damage like let's say savers, people who are trying to save for the future. And at the end of the day, they really damage like the middle and lower classes the most. If you're wealthy, you can access other assets, right? So if you're in the top 1% in Nigeria or the Philippines, for example, you can get fine art, you can buy real estate, you can get, you know, maybe gold jewelry, maybe even like you have a way of getting access to blue chip stocks on a stock market like in Japan or the United States. But if you're like in the 99%, you typically can't really do that sort of thing. So what you do is you usually take your fiat money and you buy something like a cow or like sheet metal or something like this. These are the examples that the folks at GiveDirectly told me. They're like a company that helps sort of give organizations give more directly to people. And a lot of their clients are in East Africa. And in East Africa and India, like cows are a very good store of value right over time. However, you know, the cows get sick, they die, et cetera, they get hit by a car, whatever. There are serious issues with that in addition to like them just not being very liquid. Like if you want to sell your sheet metal or your cow, there's like a lot of hoops you have to jump through. So what we're seeing now is like we're on the verge of like this new asset being born, which is which you can access permissionlessly. So unlike fine art or blue chip stocks or real estate, number one, there's not like a monetary barrier, meaning you could buy a dollar of it or 50 cents of Bitcoin. Like you could buy any amount of Bitcoin. And I mean, reasonably, like all the way down to the dust level, right? And you don't need like authority or permission. You don't need permission from the state or from a company to buy it, right? So you don't have to go through a huge process to get like real estate. In the case of real estate, it's extremely complicated to acquire real estate, right? It is very simple to acquire Bitcoin, right? So in both a financial sense and a bureaucratic sense, the bar for entry has been just like enormously lowered. And all of a sudden people are able to access this like asset class, which has a predetermined monetary policy, which cannot be inflated by governments, cannot be devalued. And this is just so powerful and revolutionary. And I think in writing the book, I realized that this, as you mentioned, the sort of monetary policy of Bitcoin is one of the most exciting and revolutionary parts of it. I mean, there's so many elements of Bitcoin that are fascinating, ranging from the censorship resistant nature of it to how it can help fight surveillance by removing the middleman, which is a privacy and security hole, to the global borderless nature of it, etc. But the fact that the monetary policy is hard capped and predetermined is really what I think will end up in the long run making it just something that gets adopted and desired by people all over the world.
How has warfare changed in this generation compared to before?
Warfare. So what I guess we're seeing is obviously you saw over the last several hundred years, war going from something that was done with like huge numbers of units, right? So like you had lots of infantry, you had large like mechanical warfare, which sort of culminated in World War II. And this was an evolution in warfare from the Middle Ages and from pre-BC ages, right? In the post-World War II era, you've seen a transformation of war going more towards like asymmetric warfare, right? So where you have like large states that still have these like large machines, which are really powerful, but they're fighting like underfunded kind of like scattered decentralized movements, right? So this was a classic case in Vietnam with the United States, with the Soviets in Afghanistan, and then the sort of like war on terror today, right? So warfare has changed dramatically over the last few decades. And generally speaking, one sort of interesting side effect, if you read Steven Pinker's book on the history of violence, is that I think in a large part because warfare is like not as large scale as it used to be, sort of like isolated, your chances of dying a violent death on this planet are way less than they used to be, right? So I think just the numbers are something like 1,000 years ago, you were like pretty likely to get killed in some sort of violent altercation. Like certainly a non-trivial amount. I can't remember exactly, but 20, 30% chance. Today, it's almost zero. Like for an average human on this planet, it is like almost 0% chance you're going to get killed in a violent altercation.
Yeah.
And that's like a pretty remarkable thing.
It's like we have all these, you know, huge, massive machines now, and just the threat of them looming makes everyone avoid actually using them. So there's a lot of more passive aggressive types of warfare that are being instituted, such as, you know, economic sanctions,
yes, financial warfare,
and trades, all kinds of things like that, embargoes. So rather than, you know, annihilating a million people with a giant bomb, you just kind of slowly starve them out until they're willing to surrender and do what you want them to do. So how is crypto and blockchain, and specifically mm-hmm. Bitcoin, working as tools for the people who are ultimately the victims of,
yeah,
you know, these two warring dictatorships or governments or ideologies? How can they use these tools to help protect themselves?
So when we talk about war, we have to talk about peace. And like, what is peace really? So most people would define peace as like lack of war between like different nation states. But really, every dictatorship, even though they might be like not in a hot war, engaged in a hot war with their neighbors, although many of them are, every dictatorship is at war with its own people every day. So the North Korean people, for example, are the victims of horrendous violence from the state, resulting in rape, torture, and murder of many thousands of people every day, right? They have 250,000 people in gulags, in these concentration camps, as a conservative estimate, in a country like North Korea. In a country like China, you've got millions of Muslim minority Uyghurs in these concentration camps. So dictatorships are always at war with their own people when they're not openly in hot wars with others, right? And if you add that to the fact that there's also, as you mentioned, other kinds of war, financial, economic sort of sanctions, repression, controls, this is another way that governments control their own people as well, right? So the Chinese are only allowed to buy a certain amount of US dollars every year. There's like super stringent rules on capital controls. It's the same for most countries that try to like control their people by like controlling, forcing them to use their fiat currency and then like controlling that. So Bitcoin's kind of breaking this open. And I'll give you a good example. Iran is a country that's, it's just a very unfortunate situation. It's really sad. It's tragic. If you're like a young entrepreneurial Iranian these days, not only are you like unable to trade abroad and participate in the international economy because of what I would say are pretty unjust sanctions by like the United States and Western powers, pretty misguided sanctions. But even worse, your government is like this tyrannical, horrible regime, which is a complete dictatorship and annihilates the human rights of its people every day. So you're kind of like caught between a rock and a hard place. But the interesting thing is Bitcoin provides people a way out. So I've spoken to a bunch of Iranians who live in Iran, and you know, they get their internet access and they're able to like earn wages with Bitcoin. You know, I can, from my table here in California, my home, I can send them within 20 minutes an amount of Bitcoin that they can then exchange on local platforms for real, the local currency, and they can buy things. I mean, this is a revolution. This is a totally new economic paradigm where we can just not be concerned with sanctions or controls by a government. When it comes to money, we can operate in this global parallel economy, which is really what Bitcoin is. So that's been pretty amazing.
Aren't there consequences for sending money via Bitcoin or via anything to a sanctioned country or to a citizen in a sanctioned country?
Yeah, there might be, but like, how are people going to figure that out? It's not so easy. Today, you would have to be the like target of a chain analysis project, right? For small amounts of money, I mean, no one's going to come after you. Yeah, like if you're sending huge amounts of money, like 5, 6 figures, 7 figures, yes, I would imagine that law enforcement officials are trying to track you down. But for small amounts of money, and if you have good operational security with your Bitcoin, I think you're pretty safe. I mean, and this is only going to get better moving forward. If you look at the privacy roadmap of Bitcoin, I mean, this thing is going to get really private in the next couple of years.
Can you talk more about that roadmap?
Yeah, sure. Well, not only you're going to have more and more people interacting with Bitcoin using second layer technologies like the Lightning Network, where you're not actually on the chain. You're not like conducting your business in a way that is trackable on this open public blockchain. You've moved off of it. So you've moved all your interactions off the chain onto a onion routed network, which is really difficult to track. I mean, the level of technical complexity and coordination required to like track and try to identify people over an onion routed network is like really hard, much more difficult than the current situation with Bitcoin.
I even saw the NSA say that it's like the only thing that they don't know how to do is track.
Well, they can try to arrest, for example, on the Tor browser, like they can try to crack down on people at the exit nodes, right? But like generally speaking, the network itself is just, it's close to impossible to monitor, right? As ironically, because the US government created Tor. But even on the Bitcoin main chain itself, like, you know, you're looking at this new BIP proposed a couple days ago, right? Erlay, right? So there's going to be, you know, a whole bunch of innovations on the base chain that will make, for example, it cheaper and more desirable to do like mixing. You're going to have innovations that will allow people to, for example, run full nodes potentially on their phones. Like you can like do this right now with like a HTC Exodus. There's a guy I spoke to in the Bitcoin community here in the Bay Area who's currently doing this. I mean, if your phone's got 300 gigs of SD memory, I mean, can run a full node on your phone and you can contribute to the decentralization and privacy of the Bitcoin network that way, right? So there's a lot of things happening both with like the software itself, the hardware, and then second layer technologies, so that in like 2 years, it just seems like really, really, it'll be really, really, really hard for people to track these flows of money. Now, you know, are people being caught right now? It's unclear. I mean, the US government certainly has like tried to like publicize like several like Bitcoin addresses and put them on a blacklist. But generally speaking, inside Iran, Bitcoin is a legal industry. I mean, there's even like mosques that are taking advantage of like the fact that energy is subsidized and they're running Bitcoin mining operations.
Yeah, I've been reading the news that Iran is subsidizing like certain energy stuff for Bitcoin miners.
So it's a little bit of a dance. I mean, you look at a place like China or Iran, and this is where we're actually going to see, it's like the canary in the coal mine of Bitcoin. Like we're going to see governments crack down in these places first before elsewhere. I mean, obviously in Venezuela, you've been seeing the government, for example, try to accumulate Bitcoin, try to look at the electric grid and imprison people who are obviously mining. But the interesting thing is, whether it's North Korea or Iran or Venezuela or Russia or China, the countries that are trying to like use Bitcoin, that are starting to realize, Belarus even the other day mentioned this. I mean, countries that are run by dictators who are starting to realize maybe they can like, maybe it would be smart for them to like accumulate Bitcoin and use it to avoid sanctions or whatever. You know, what's interesting is like short term, this may be good for them, but long term, it's like a Trojan horse, man. Like long term, what this does is it shatters their ability to control the money system in their countries. So if it's almost, again, it's like almost like this perfect Trojan horse thing where like they think it's good and cool and pretty and interesting, and they start popularizing and they bring Bitcoin into their countries and they start using it. Over time, this is going to destroy their ability to control the money system, because all of a sudden, like there's just going to be a lot more people using this thing that they can't control. They can't control the monetary policy. They cannot confiscate from people. It's confiscation resistant. They cannot censor. It's censorship resistant. It's going to be a lot more private, a lot more hard to track. So the geopolitical game that's being played and is unfolding right now is really, really interesting. But I certainly am optimistic that Bitcoin's going to make life a lot harder for a lot of these dictators.
All right, Crypt Nation, real quick update from the good folks over at eToro, who make my life possible, and frankly, Pizza Mind's life possible too. If you don't know about them yet, well, you're about to. And if you haven't, I'm actually pretty surprised, because these cats are everywhere. They are an exchange with over 10 million users spread across 140 countries.
And I'd imagine that some of you are already, but the rest of you really need to go check it out. eToro is the exchange where the average consumer can buy and sell crypto with confidence. eToro is super fast, super liquid, very easy to use compared to some of the other exchanges. I mean, this is just the best place to start. And they've been around since 2007.
100%. And another super cool aspect of eToro is that if you're not ready to put real money in the market, you can trade with up to $100,000 of virtual money while you learn. So this is kind of a way that you can test the waters and get familiar with executing trades. You can learn market analysis, all these things before you actually put your hard-earned money at risk. It's actually pretty brilliant.
Yeah, I wish I knew about this when I got started. And that's why we're bringing it to you guys. So go to crypto101podcast.com/eToro, sign up and see the difference for yourself.
And remember, not all platforms are created equal. All right, back to the show.
Speaking of not just Bitcoin, but going back to blockchain technology itself, a lot of us armchair evangelists that like to sit on Twitter and think of how blockchain can possibly change the world. One of the main ones is decentralized governance and also voting on blockchain to prevent corrupt elections and things like that. Is that just wishful thinking on our parts from our comfortable homes far, far away from these problems? Or can these solutions actually be implemented and make a difference? Or will the militias that back these dictators just simply say, I don't care what these results are. I don't care what the people think. We're just going to continue our forceful dominance.
Right. So there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, from first principles, in my reading of, like, let's say a democratic society, an open society, the actual election itself is like the cherry on top. Okay. It's like, there's like a multi-layer cake here, and foundation is separation of powers. Okay. So like the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the military, they have to be like separated. They can't all be controlled by the same person. So once you have that, then you can sort of add on to the next layer, which is civil societies, NGOs, different groups that operate without, basically permission from or aren't controlled by the government. And then these can range from like stamp collecting clubs to baseball teams to environmental groups, et cetera. And then you have the third layer, which is free expression. So my ability to right, not only in the media and do investigative journalism, but also to speak freely, to criticize the government. When you have all three of these things, you basically have all the ingredients for democracy. And then the elections are just like a mechanism for rotating new leaders in that represent the people. Democracy, obviously the word in Greek is, you know, ruled by the people, right? So at the end of the day, the voting and the elections to me are like, they're important, but they're like not as important as all these other aspects. So the technology of voting, while important, I don't think it's going to be like a savior or a panacea, that's for sure. So that's like one piece that we should be careful of. The second piece is, so there are some people, a friend of mine is Santiago Siri, you know, he's been doing some experimentation with like quadratic voting, which I find really interesting. I mean, just in a nutshell, one example would be like, you know, if instead of just a vote, you were given like a certain amount of voting units, you could, in like, if you really felt strongly about one policy or one candidate, you could just dump all of your units into voting for that one person, as opposed to just like having this, like in California, let's say I don't care about the local school district. I don't know enough to vote on those things. I could take all my units and just vote just for the mayor, right? And it would count for like more than one vote, right? So this idea of quadratic voting is really interesting, and I'm certainly following that. Now, I don't know to the extent that it relies on or needs a blockchain, I think is the area where I'm like still learning and probably pretty skeptical. Like I don't, like to me, like the only way a blockchain works is if its security model's robust, right? So in the case of Bitcoin, it has like a super secure protection model rooted in physics and thermodynamics and game theory and in cash, in money.
The really cool thing about Bitcoin is other projects can actually use that. For example, Komodo uses the Bitcoin blockchain to secure its own transactions. It has its own layer of miners doing proof of stake. Mm-hmm. And then after that, the transaction has to confirm using Bitcoin hashes. And then it has to confirm again. So it's got this three-layer thing that actually utilizes Bitcoin security for other chains as well. And then you can spin up side chains on that. So you can actually use Bitcoin's amazing amount of security for just about anything now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know that. I'm not familiar with that project. At the end of the day, though, like Bitcoin's just a database. Like you can put anything you want into it, into one of the blocks. How are we supposed to know whether it's nonsense or not? So like, sure, like you could arbitrarily use the Bitcoin blockchain and you could like put voting data or consensus or historical notes in there, but like no outside observer has any way of determining whether that's like helpful or true or false. You could just as easily spread a bunch of nonsense. It's this sort of like Oracle problem of computer science, where if it's garbage data in, it's garbage data out. And this is why at the moment, I'm not like, this is why we haven't seen like large scale, successful, real world implementations of like blockchain databases beyond like currency projects like Bitcoin. There's just no, it just doesn't really make any sense from a first principles point of view. Like you have like a fish you're trying to track for someone who's going to eat it and they want to know where it came from. I mean, the person who inputs the weight at a particular point could just lie or make it up or make a mistake. And like no other user would be able to understand that that happened, right? So I just think a lot of these like supply chain tracking, trying to put anything into a blockchain that's like a real world thing that's not digitally native, like doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. So I just haven't seen anything world changing from that perspective. I do think there's like innovations in voting that are interesting. And certainly we need to focus on like gerrymandering first, I think, and like clean elections. And I think we can look at like press freedom laws and, you know, that stuff seems more fundamental to me than the actual like, oh, at the end, like when you have voting, like how do we mechanically do it? I actually think the process is that that's not really the problem. The problem comes sort of like before voting day in most countries. So when votes are rigged, they're usually not like ballot boxes being stuffed. It's usually like the main candidates, you know, besides the dictator, the opposition candidates like don't get public funding for television advertisement, for example. So that like the it's like the cards are stacked against them from the beginning. So I think when we talk about like how to like build and more robust democracies and how to improve electoral, systems, I think a lot of the work is to be done before election day. Now I'm intrigued by like new advances in voting, but like clearly like they're just experimental at this point. They may be implemented in like some small scale like situations in certain cities and stuff, but like we're pretty far away from this. I mean, David Chaum, who's obviously one of the cypherpunks who helped invent technology that would later power Bitcoin, is also really interested in this area. And he, in like, I think 2000, about 10 years ago, he did a project with a city in Maryland, I believe, where they implemented, I think, quadratic voting of some type. But it, you know, it was an experiment and it was kind of cool. And then they moved on. Like, it's not like it caught fire and spread. So these things are kind of hard to implement because at the end of the day, there's no economic power behind them. I mean, the reason why Bitcoin works and is being spread and adopted is not only because it's secure, but also because there's just a lot of like skin in the game for people. Like people have a lot to win. People have a lot to, they can make a lot of money by being involved, right?
Yeah, that's it. I love that point.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just like, it's hard for me to buy like blockchain projects that are either like, you know, corporate coordination efforts or tracking stuff or voting, et cetera, where there's not like money involved. It just seems like that was the thing that Satoshi Nakamoto was trying to solve, was this idea of like, we needed a money system with nobody in the middle. Well, how can we do that? Well, we can have payment processing decentralized through a blockchain, through a time, he didn't even use that word, but a time stamped database, right? Mm-hmm. We could have it done in this way. All of his effort was to how do we build money that the government doesn't control? This is like the focus, right? So I feel like some people have been a little distracted by looking at like the blockchain piece, but like really, I mean, a timestamped distributed database is like not that exciting.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the success of Bitcoin, as you just said, it's inextricable from its economic qualities, right? And so we hear this term thrown around a lot in the crypto world called, you know, an anarcho-capitalist. And okay, so do you think that like the future of, you know, governance is, you know, if Bitcoin plays out, is that the future? A more of an anarchistic and, you know, economic focused government?
Yeah, I think what's most likely to happen with the future of governance, if you're a betting man, is unfortunately a global authoritarian surveillance state. I mean, that's probably the most likely outcome, especially if Bitcoin didn't exist. Okay. I think what Bitcoin gives us a chance at, what Bitcoin gives us an opportunity, I would say it's non-trivial, but also not like, I would say somewhere like in the 20% range, let's just call it that, that we actually preserve our democracies and preserve individual rights and freedoms, and we don't have this big global authoritarian surveillance state. I mean, I would still say it's like the smart money would be on a China-like global imperial power that just like sort of has total knowledge over everybody. That's certainly the direction that AI technology is going in. I mean, there's just, if you rack your brain about it, it's really hard to think of any way that AI could improve civil liberties. It just doesn't really work like that. But Bitcoin, in its ability to like allow individuals to transact with each other directly with no middlemen, gives us the power to sort of like weaken that surveillance state. Like if you think about what Big Brother is an attempt to collect as much data and information as possible about you, right? So if you and I all of a sudden are transacting without like metadata, really, and if we're not building a big digital footprint for Big Brother to eat up and like be able to build predictive models about us and then do carrots and sticks and socially engineer us, if we're at the base level not allowing that to happen, then we can fight Big Brother, right? So Bitcoin allows us to be able to like transact in this peer-to-peer way. It also allows us to like seize monetary sovereignty for ourselves. Like we can like control our money and it's not going to get devalued by governments. And I think that's like such a powerful idea. And again, you have this like interesting duality of like features of Bitcoin and then like its monetary qualities. And these are inextricably linked, as you're saying. So there's like censorship resistance and the borderless global nature of it, which are all cool and really fascinating. But like at the end of the day, it's just the fact that it's just like the hardest money the world's ever seen. And it just will bend other things to its will. This is like what I believe at the end of the day. So I think with the emergence of Bitcoin, like we have a shot at fighting back against this like otherwise inevitable global authoritarian surveillance state.
One of the biggest concerns I have with Bitcoin is not Bitcoin itself. I mean, as a system, we've talked about all the great qualities of it. But now that governments around the world and institutions are getting involved in collecting it and hoarding it, mm-hmm. I mean, just by the nature of supply and demand, you know, everything's, oh, this is going to go up. You know, it's going to be great for me. I'm in early on Bitcoin. But what happens if these governments that have trillions of dollars simply just buy up the Bitcoin supply and G20 countries all decide, okay, you know, we're going to clamp down very, very strictly on ramps and off ramps or wallets? I mean, there's still going to be a very small black market that's going to figure things out. For example, you know, we can physically trade wallets without actually doing transactions and things like that. But what happens, you know, after Bitcoin, if it gets taken over, do we just fork another one?
I think there's a lot of truth in what you said, but consider this. People who hold Bitcoin today, large amounts of it, I mean, a lot of these people hold it ideologically. They're not going to sell it to the Chinese government. This is not like what they're interested in. And they believe that the price they could sell it for today is peanuts compared to what they could sell it for in 30 years. So I think there's a really good chance that like the decentralized, unknown, anonymous distributed network of basically geeks and computer nerds who hold a huge amount of Bitcoin, they're not giving it up to anybody. And I think we can be pretty sure of that. Now the traders, you know, and people who are like trying to make money and institutional investors, yeah, they're going to be interested in buying and selling Bitcoin. And that I guess that presents opportunities for governments to come in and scoop up what's in the order books. But right now, there's not a whole heck of a lot of Bitcoin in the order books. They're pretty thin. And this is what attributes a lot of the volatility of Bitcoin is attributable to this. Like, you know, a whale can come in and just totally fuck up the markets for a day or two. That won't be possible in the future when this is a more robust asset, that would be my prediction. But generally speaking, I think governments have been really dumb and like have overlooked and have been arrogant and have like they just haven't really understood the power of Bitcoin, and they kind of missed their opportunity. It's just too late, man. It's just too late. I mean, yeah, they can try to accumulate it now, but like they won't be able to accumulate the majority of it, and certainly not any one government. And it's all going to be a race. And even, let's just put it this way, even if governments manage to accumulate 40-50% of all the Bitcoin in the world somehow for the next 10 years, I mean, it seems highly unlikely, but let's say they do it, that will make the amount of Bitcoins that the people in those countries own, even if they're smaller amounts, so valuable that it gives them enormous power, right? So it's this kind of like damned if you do, damned if you don't situation for governments, I think. It's sort of just, to me, it's kind of the writing's on the wall. This is kind of inevitable. Like, yes, there'll be massive amounts of restrictions potentially in different countries. But the countries that don't put those restrictions, the countries that are the least draconian, the countries that are the most open-minded towards Bitcoin, are going to attract the talent, are going to be the next Silicon Valley, right? I don't know whether that's like little island countries like Malta or Seychelles or whatever, or whether it's bigger countries. I don't know. I don't know whether there'll be dictatorships or democracies. It's unclear. Sadly, even democracies, even Northern Europe, apparently free countries, they seem to be the ones that want to crack down the most on financial freedom, which is really sad, but it's just the truth. Look at a country like Finland or something like that. This is an open and free country, but it wants to know everything about the banking system. And, you know, these people are just so thirsty for all of your data. So it's kind of sad.
Yeah, I could kind of see a future that is similar to what happened when I think it was like FDR in 1930 or 1933. He did the gold confiscation, where he basically made it illegal for anybody in America. I mean, people don't realize that this happened, but at one point in history, it was illegal to hold or to hoard gold. And they did this because they needed to, you know, refill their supplies. Essentially, we were still on the gold standard. And, you know, then in 1971, we went off the gold standard. But I kind of feel like there could be a future where it is now illegal to hoard Bitcoin or something. I don't know. Maybe there's an analog that you could speak about.
If you look at the price of gold, in the FDR era, right? You're talking like $300, $400, $500, $600, you know, today it's like $1,500 or something like that. Right. So governments can try to restrict gold, and they can try to restrict the usage of it and try to confiscate it, et cetera. But I think in doing so, you kind of like make it more valuable. Right. So if a government comes out and says, oh, we're going to ban Bitcoin, I mean, this is going to create such a crazy black market. I mean, you'd have to think that the price is just going to go up. And this is the interesting thing, is that it's so geniusly devised. It's almost devious in its nature from a government perspective. Like, no matter what a government does, it's very difficult to kill. I mean, the more they try to like ban and control it, the more valuable it'll get, right? So we'll have to see. I mean, look, we're in 2019. We've already seen 10 years of the Bitcoin experiment. The world's largest police state as of today, China, views Bitcoin as legal digital property. Yes, you're not allowed to trade it into and out of fiat currency. You're not allowed to do ICOs and stuff like that. But Bitcoin is considered legal property. So we'll have to see. That's what I'm saying. Like, look at a country like China as like the canary in the coal mine situation. Follow what's happening there. There's people who are really incisive about what's happening in China. You can follow someone like W. Wang, Primitive Ventures, to get an understanding of what's going on over there. But like, if the world's largest police state hasn't banned Bitcoin, then like, you know, it's probably indicative of what other countries are thinking. It's also this geopolitical thing where, no, you know, we're not living in a world where 180 countries or whatever are all going to agree on something. That's like not going to happen. So let's say China, Russia, the United States, EU, India, Brazil, like, you know, 2/3 of the population of the world all agree, actually, oh, we're going to ban Bitcoin. Like, we're worried about our monetary sovereignty. First of all, they have to fight Facebook and Google and Amazon, all these corporate money projects. So there's going to be like two fights happening. But basically, there are going to be countries that say, we're not going to ban Bitcoin. We're going to actually make it free and legal here. And we're going to attract all the talent. So all the Bitcoin exchanges, all the developers, all the miners, whatever, they can come here, right? So it just seems highly unlikely that you're going to have like global consensus on banning this thing. It's just doesn't, I highly doubt it's going to play out like that. Instead, you're going to see like a competition.
Yeah. And if countries do try and ban it, there's always a black market. Like, no matter where in the world you are, there's always going to be a demand for this thing. And there's always going to be a venue to trade it, right? It's a peer-to-peer currency. It's, you know, unconfiscatable. You can't really stop these transactions. And so one way or another, this thing is still going to live.
Yeah. And like, again, the technology is evolving in a way where like I still think Bitcoin remains under the radar for a couple more years, meaning like from an establishment point of view, I still think it remains at the bottom of its S curve for a couple more years, like meaning only 1% global awareness, which is, we're barely there yet. If you consider that 40, 50, 60 million people have meaningfully interacted with Bitcoin, I mean, that's less than 1% of the population.
Yeah, we're still underdogs.
We're still like at the, you know, the S curve of any technology, you know, goes like this. So if I think we're still going to be there for a couple more years, and the price will probably kind of move sideways accordingly, but we'll have to see. But there's still lots of opportunities for people to get involved and for us to like to study and learn. I mean, there's just another piece that came out by Matt Alborg the other day. He launched a new project to help us understand, using local exchange data from local Bitcoins and Paxful, where we can see that like the usage of Bitcoin as a financial tool is on the rise in a lot of developing countries and a lot of emerging economies. And it would make sense, you know, that they have people in these countries have highly restrictive financial rules. Their currency sucks. And it's very difficult for them to get any sort of asset that, you know, is reasonably inflation resistant. So it once the cat's out of the bag in some of these places, it's going to start to like just bloom, I would say, like the interest in Bitcoin. So I don't even think we're there yet, which is kind of exciting. We're very much on the edge.
This has been a fascinating conversation. And before we wrap it up, I just want to ask a couple more questions.
Sure.
Can you tell us a little more in detail about the Human Rights Foundation and what they're actually doing on the ground to try and help combat this stuff and spread Bitcoin around the world?
Yeah, I mean, we're not, you know, we're like a nonprofit advocacy organization that's focused on helping promote free speech, democracy, and other civil liberties. So we're not like a Bitcoin organization. But what we are observing is that a lot of these people we work with have massive infringements on their financial freedoms. on their ability to transact and hold private property, et cetera. And we're conducting research and analysis to try and understand, like, why are people adopting Bitcoin? How are they doing it? And potentially, if it is going to be this tool of freedom and an escape valve, like, how can we do more education around it? How can we talk to more dissidents and human rights activists and introduce them to it? It's sort of like 10, 15 years ago, like with encrypted messaging, where, like, one day, we worked with all these activists who are in highly dangerous situations. And, like, there was a point where, like, barely any of them used any sort of encrypted messaging. They just used, like, standard social media, right? Which is, like, highly prone to surveillance. So over time, we and many other groups have worked with activists around the world. And now they have, like, a reasonable, let's say, education level on, like, oh, maybe I should use something like Signal, right? So it takes a lot of time. So today, I'd sit down with people from dozens of countries and they just haven't really thought about Bitcoin. And I ask them questions about, like, well, doesn't the government shut down your bank account? Isn't it really hard for you to receive money and donations from around the world? They're like, yes, 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 yes. Well, how do you get money from one country to another? Well, we put it in a bag in cash. It's ridiculous, right? So people know that there's a money problem, but they haven't learned that Bitcoin can help them. And so one of the things we're doing is try to do some basic trainings and, you know, spread some awareness among these communities about what this is. At the end of the day, I want the activists and do-gooders and democracy activists and protesters and journalists to learn about and become knowledgeable about Bitcoin before the governments do. That would be great. And that's, like, I think one thing that we can help with.
That's amazing. I love, yeah, thank you for all the work and the education that you're doing around the world. If you were to, you know, give a shout out to one other company, mm-hmm. or maybe even one other nonprofit, perhaps one of each, which one, like, is having the most impact in your mind besides your organization?
Yeah. I mean, I think Coin Center is really important. The work they're doing to try and educate US policymakers on why they shouldn't regulate Bitcoin, and why Bitcoin in many ways is very American, in the idea of keeping digital cash alive in a cashless society, is really key. And that privacy is an American value and that freedom is an American value, all these things. I think they're doing tremendously valuable work. And then, because it then, like, sort of diffuses to other jurisdictions, right? So if they can, like, win and keep America a relatively friendly place for Bitcoin, that will, like, have huge second order effects in other countries and places, right? So I would say that, like, supporting them and interacting and engaging with Coin Center would be, like, a really important thing for people to do right now. And I mean, they do so much with so little. I mean, I've been to their tiny office in DC. I think they have, like, 4 people or something like that. So certainly check out Coin Center.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I know Niraj is very active on Twitter. I love following him. He's always pretty funny.
Yeah, support Jerry, Peter, Niraj, support them all.
Sweet. Well, Alex, man, thank you so much for your time today. I know I learned a lot and I think the audience is really, really going to enjoy this. So if we want to stay in touch with you or follow mm-hmm. your guys' socials, can you shout those out real quick?
Yeah. So follow me, my last name on Twitter, Gladstein, GLADSTEIN. You can follow the Human Rights Foundation at HRF. We have some events coming up that your listeners may want to engage with and check out.
Absolutely.
So the one I'll put on your radar is the Oslo Freedom Forum in New York, coming up on October 23rd in Midtown Manhattan, a one-day opportunity for you to meet some of the most amazing activists from around the world. We have Denise Ho, who's this, like, cantopop star from Hong Kong, who's become, like, the face of the protest movement. We have Taeyong Ho, who's the highest ranking diplomat to ever escape from North Korea, coming to give his insight into the mind of Kim Jong-un. We have a professor who is going to give us, like, a blow by blow of what's happening with Huawei and the Belt and Road and 5G and, like, the Chinese government's, like, surveillance project. We've got an amazing activist from Iran she's created this thing called White Wednesday. So these, like, women in Iran are, like, filming themselves taking off their headscarves and then, like, posting it on social media, and it's going viral.
Holy.
As, like, a way to fight the patriarchy. So there's a lot of really awesome, it's going to be an amazing program. So Oslo Freedom Forum in New York, you can get tickets on Ticketmaster, and we tried to make them really, like, accessible. So it's like $10 for students, $50 for general admission. And then there's like a VIP level where you can come out to dinner with the speakers after. But highly recommend checking out the Oslo Freedom Forum in New York. There will probably be like a Bitcoin crypto related meetup either before or after. It's like a 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. event. So maybe there'll be a lunch thing, or maybe there'll be like a cocktail hour thing. But we'll try to work on doing that. So these are some thoughts.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. And I know I'm going to keep that at the front of my mind when I'm talking to people about some upcoming events. So Oslo Freedom Forum in New York, November 23rd, you said?
October 23rd.
October 23rd. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, and you can, you know, href.org, you can check out our website. You can see everything we're doing.
And where can people buy your book?
On Amazon. So you can check it out on Amazon, The Little Bitcoin Book. Leave us a review. Leave us a review on Goodreads. We'd be very grateful. And if any of your listeners want to translate the book into different languages, we're currently, Spanish is pretty much done. We're getting Chinese done, which is really exciting. We're getting Arabic done. And I believe we're getting French done at the moment. So we want to do Turkish, German, Italian. So if your listeners have abilities to do that stuff, please get in touch with us. So again, you can reach me on Twitter at Gladstein, G-L-A-D-S-T-E-I-N. Just send me a message.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing all your wisdom with us. And hopefully we have you back on here pretty soon.
Anytime, man.
I feel like we could talk about just fucking everything.
Yeah, we can keep going. All right. It's been a lot of fun. Let's talk soon.
Take it
easy.
Thanks,
guys.